This podcast features graphic details of real events taken from letters written by inmates convicted of murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Am I the same person who committed the crime? I think the question would be better answered by someone who knew me then and knows me now. But if I have to answer it, I'll say, hell no.
These are the written words of Texas death row inmate number 999508, Christopher Young.
I'm a lot more mature, and am really glad I came to death row.
They're taken from letters that he wrote to us in 2016 and 2017.
I truly believe that death row saved my life, as crazy as that sounds.
My name is Zoe Hines, and Christopher Young is one of over 2,000 inmates that my colleague Ned Parker and I have corresponded with in our work as documentary producers.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast. Episode 13, Death Row Reform.
You think you know a criminal case, and then you don't. You spend months poring over police files, affidavits, floor plans, and phone recordings until you're certain you've got a decent sense of what happened in those specific moments. But then, someone says something. New evidence comes in. Or, as in today's case, you finally gain access to court records. And then, in the space of that split second it takes to form a nagging doubt, all your assumptions, your preconceptions, and your theories can be flipped upside down. You find yourself doubting wrong from right, feeling naive, perhaps even betrayed. And you're reminded that a missing puzzle piece can change the entire picture.
As with many of the cases that land on our desk, initially we have a very small amount of information about the crime. So often, a lot of our first impressions are based on what is told to us by the killer themselves in their letters.
Once an inmate begins corresponding with us, we start looking further into that case. And often, that's when we discover details that challenge our perception of both the crime itself and the perpetrator.
Before we find out more about Christopher Young himself, let's hear the details of his case file.
Letters from a Killer. Case file. The following information is taken from Christopher Young's court case, as well as CCTV footage of the murder. November 2004. Christopher Young had been drinking all night. He left his house to travel to work, but he didn't catch the bus that morning. Instead, he abducted a woman in a red Mazda sports car. He held his victim, Daphne Edwards, at gunpoint, stealing her purse in the process, and then also stealing her car. Shortly after, it is believed that Young drove to a mini-mart and dry cleaners, owned by 55-year-old Hasmukhbai Hash Patel. Young entered the store and allegedly announced, "Give up the money, I'm not playing," while brandishing a silver handgun. He allegedly ordered Patel to give him the money one more time before firing a shot towards him, at which point the store alarm sounded. CCTV footage caught Young demanding the money again and moving towards the cash register. Moments later, he exited the store. Two of Patel's regular customers were in the parking lot at the time. On hearing gunshots, they gave chase, but with no success. Both positively identified Young at his trial.
Christopher Young's case seemed fairly straightforward at first. On the basis of what he wrote to us in his letters, his story felt reminiscent of many cases that we've heard before, featuring a troubled childhood which had led to gang and drug culture crimes.
Let's hear the first extract from his letters, where Christopher Young writes to us about that childhood. The following lines are read by an actor, but these are Christopher Young's words, as written to us from prison.
Please be informed. I'm a very blunt individual that has come to a complete understanding of my situation. This means some things might sound harsh, but I'm just speaking on reality. And reality is harsh. With that said, everything will be factual. I was born in San Antonio, Texas, on the city's east side. The drug and gang culture was thriving and spreading through that side of town. Crack cocaine was ripping apart families and flooding the streets. I grew up in a small six-room house. Every day, I looked forward to going to school. School was my safe haven. I tried to stay involved in every after-school activity, just to stay there as long as possible. When I was 8 years old, my father was murdered during a robbery. His head was blown off by a friend, sitting behind him in his car. This was a major turning point in my life. I became a recluse and wouldn't speak to anyone for months. I tried to stay in the activities in school, but it wasn't the same. At the time, I was playing four instruments, violin, viola, bass, and cello. And I was a chess star that was going to city and state competitions. I used to want to be a police officer when I was young. I remember this because of a picture I drew with me helping someone lying in the street.
In these opening lines, Young establishes that he grew up in a community where drugs and violence were normalized. But he's at pains to distinguish himself from that from the start here, establishing school and academic pursuits as a safe haven. Young then flip-flops back and forth between these two parallel worlds, juxtaposing descriptions of extreme violence with a list of instruments he played and his academic prowess.
That dangerous environment, of course, comes crashing directly into Young's childhood at the moment his father is brutally killed by a friend. And that is a horrific image. There's absolutely no way that your father being murdered when you're only 8 years old could not have a serious psychological impact on you. And I think if we're going to try and understand why it is that people commit murders, going back into their childhood and finding such traumatic events as this, I think helps you understand how people do start down a path, and a path which can end up in such a bad place as it did for Christopher.
What this passage also demonstrates for me is that Young is a very aware writer. It's clear he's told this story before. He knows that his reader will feel for a young man with aspirations surrounded by bad influences. And he firmly establishes this before contextualising his dad's murder as, quite understandably, the major turning point in his life.
After my father's murder, everything changed for me. A couple of months after, one of my uncles, who I looked up to, was sent to prison for murder. He was a high-ranking gang member. I then chose to join the same gang he was involved in. I became a blood at the age of 8. My first time going to jail was at 11 years old. I was going to school on the east side, where there was a mixture of bloods and crips. I had a fight at least 3 times a week because of gangs. I went to jail a second time at the age of 12 for an assault on my mother. We were in an argument that day for something, and she hit me. I didn't cry. She went to her room and got a stun gun and shocked me with it. I woke up in the back of a police car on the way to jail again. I stayed there for 2 months until my aunt came and got me. I bounced around from family member to family member until I was back with my mother again. I was back in jail for the third time at the age of 13 for another assault on my mother.
Young writes about being a blood from the age of 8 and landing in jail for the third time by the age of 13 here. In just a few phrases, this really does set his childhood apart.
Now, the Crips and the Bloods are famous or infamous gangs which originated out of LA and then spread across the whole of the US. They aren't the same as organized crime in a mafia sense, but they are recognized gangs who are known for being incredibly violent. There are blood feuds and there can be severe gang violence between the two groups. So for an 8-year-old to be involved in any way in that, or even to be recognized as being a member of a particular gang, for me that's really shocking.
At this stage, we're learning details of the crime from Young's letters. It's his version of events. But Young's recollection of the murder, is at odds with the prosecuting attorney's version. Whereas Young does not deny he killed Patel, he does contest that it wasn't a deliberate and cold-blooded murder, as was presented in court.
I was with the mother of my second child at the time. Me and her didn't get along. The victim owned a convenience store with the dry cleaners attached. She would take my clothes to get them dry cleaned. One day, her and the owner got in an argument. She told him he needed to be more careful with one of my shirts. He allegedly called her a bitch. When she told me about it, I was pissed. I was a huge hothead and an alcoholic at the time. So anyone messed with my family, I wanted to do something about it. I stayed up all night drinking. In the morning, I was leaving the house to go to work when a woman pulled up in her car. Because I was going to the bus stop and drunk, I decided to just take her car. So I put my gun to her head and pulled her out of the car and jumped in while taking her purse in the process. I drove out of the apartments and turned on the main street where the convenience store was. When I seen the store, the confrontation the owner had with my child's mother flashed back into my head. So I pulled into the store, waiting to confront him about it. I walked in the store and pulled the gun I had, asking him about calling my girl a bitch. That's when everything went wild. He hit the alarm and started moving back and forth. I told him to be still. He reached his hand under the counter, so I fired a shot into the wall behind him. I wanted to get out of the store by this time, but was scared he was going to reach for something and shoot me in the back. He reached under the counter again, and I shot him in the top of the hand. He shook his hand from the bullet wound twice and grabbed his chest. He then fell and hit the ground. I left. The entire murder is on videotape. I was arrested about an hour later. I didn't know he was dead. When I found out, I didn't feel anything about him. In my mind, I told myself I would be shot if I tried to run out the store.
So here is Christopher Young telling us that the shooting of Patel was an accident. It was self-defense. He writes that the shooting was just a shot to the hand, and yet, in his own words, he does still describe this event as murder.
This is, for me, one of the most interesting passages of the letters that Christopher Young wrote to us, because it suddenly completely changes my understanding of the case. I'd made the assumption that this was a robbery, but you now realise that there was a motivation here. Not the accident he's talking about, but a personal motivation, potentially even a hatred towards his victim, Patel. And that's balanced with this explanation of suddenly deciding, drunk in the morning, to hijack the car of a woman at gunpoint. So reading this, I'm beginning to question who Young really is.
Young knows that there was CCTV throughout this incident, and he knows that it's been presented at court. From that footage, we understand that Young's motivation for entering the store was to rob Patel. And yet, Young doesn't mention robbery here at all. So the fact that he brings personal motivation into this version of the story does seem like self-editing. And it begs the question, why?
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast.
Let's pause our episode of Letters from a Killer for a minute to tell you about our sponsor. 2020 reminded us all to prepare for the unexpected. This year, be prepared for when you need to pull an outfit together that doesn't include your sweatpants. Get Stitch Fix today so that you can emerge from lockdown with your best style ever.
I wasn't sure about an online personal styling company at first, but I've been trying it out this week and it's pretty impressive. I went to stitchfix.co.uk/letters to set up my profile, and a personal stylist sent me outfits that were personalised to me. I chose the colours, the styles and the budget.
You pay a £10 styling fee for each fix, which is credited towards anything you keep. Schedule at any time, there's no subscription required. Plus, shipping, returns and exchanges are easy and free.
You can even preview selections and be sure to get exactly your style, or let Stitch Fix do the hard work for you and send you surprises. It's basically like having your own personal stylist.
Get started today at stitchfix.co.uk/letters and you'll get 20% off when you keep everything in your fix.
That's stitchfix.co.uk/letters for 20% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.co.uk/letters.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast.
Taking a life is not easy. Living with that burden comes to me all the time. Although I didn't try nor want to kill that man, I hate that it happened. What makes it even worse when it comes to this crime is now, I don't believe the confrontation my child's mother told me about ever happened. She was the first person to testify against me at my trial.
The fact that the mother of Christopher Young's child wasn't present at the event, yet was willing to testify against him, perhaps tells us something about their relationship. And Young is certainly painting an interesting picture of himself at this point. He claims he's been victimised. He was duped into feelings that resulted in this. It's pushing the blame elsewhere.
As we've explained, there is a clear difference between the accounts that Christopher Young has written to us and the version of events presented in court, those which actually led to his conviction. And normally we would hear the verdict later in an episode, but I think it's important to hear what happened to him now, because a large part of this story is about what happened next to Christopher Young.
Letters from a Killer. The verdict. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. In February 2006, Christopher Young was given the death sentence. In 2014, Young appealed his sentence, but this appeal was denied and he remained on death row. In 2018, Young filed a last-minute appeal. This was also denied. On July 17th, 2018, Christopher Young was led into the execution chamber in Huntsville, Texas. At 6:13 p.m., a lethal injection was administered. Christopher Young was pronounced dead at 6:38 p.m.
We now know that Christopher Young was given the death penalty and that this sentence was carried out in 2018. But in his letters to us just 2 years before his death, he writes about how much he believed that he had changed as a person since being sent to death row. He writes about how death row had apparently reformed him.
Am I the same person who committed the crime? I think the question would be better answered by someone who knew me then and knows me now. But if I have to answer it, I'll say, hell no. I'm a lot more mature, and I'm really glad I came to death row. I truly believe that death row saved my life, as crazy as that sounds. I know I wouldn't be as mature as I am now. I was locked up at the age of 21. I'm 33 now. The numerous activities I'm involved with would have never come to me without coming to death row. I'm a great painter, I've written 2 books, and I'm working on a movie at the moment. I started a mentor program where I mentor kids in the attempt to stop them from coming to a place like this. I know I'm a different person. How do I feel about the victim? I have a lot of empathy for them. I think more about his children than him. He's gone, but he has a son my age. And because my father was murdered, I know exactly what he's going through. There's times I wish I could sit down and talk to him, not only to apologize, but to explain what really happened. I also want to show him that, yes, I murdered his father. But there's a lot that came from this incident that's good.
The US prison system does run victim impact courses that encourage inmates to think about those family members who've been affected by their crimes. And there are even, in some facilities, restorative justice programs where offenders can meet and apologise directly to the families.
And during his years in prison, Christopher Young did develop a relationship with the family of his victim, Harsh Patel, and in particular with his son.
Young's mentoring work with young people resonated with Patel's family, and at the time of his first appeal in 2014, Patel's son actually spoke out strongly in Young's defence, saying,
"Chris dying wouldn't do anything to change our journey. He killed my dad. Now you're killing him. Two wrongs don't make a right. My dad was doing positive things, and Chris took that away from him. Now, I look at Chris trying to do something positive, and if the state takes that away from him, they're no different than Chris."
He then actually spoke at a rally calling for clemency for Young, and even appealed to the Texas Board of Parole and Pardons. Now, as we heard, that appeal failed, and after Young's execution by the state, the victim's son said the following to reporters.
"The man that was executed today by the state of Texas was not the same man that killed Hasmukhbai Patel. Christopher was a father to his daughters and a man who desired to break the cycle of gang violence through mentorship."
However, as we've heard, the end did come for Christopher Young in July 2018 when he was executed.
The final statements made by Christopher Young were released by officials at that time. And here is what he said.
"I want to make sure the Patel family knows I love them like they love me. Make sure the kids in the world know I'm being executed. And the kids I've been mentoring, keep this fight going. I'm good, Warden."
Reading these letters provokes a lot of contradictory emotions. Learning that the victim's family had recognized the change in him since being on death row does make a difference for me. But I think it's interesting, and it's really important here to note, that not everybody had forgiven Christopher Young. And most notably, the family of the woman whose car he stole, Daphne Edwards.
The Edwards family were vocal about their desire to see Christopher Young executed. And this is important because there was something that really troubled us about Young's letters that we haven't yet touched upon. And that was the way in which he represented Daphne Edwards' hijacking. Young's account of those events is immeasurably different from the version we discovered had been presented at court in a civil trial.
Because in court, it was stated that Young did not simply steal Daphne Edwards' car at gunpoint after randomly coming across her in the street. Rather, he had invaded her home, and while he was there, and before he stole the car and drove it to the store where he murdered Patel, he viciously assaulted Daphne Edwards. Here's the statement as heard in court.
"On the morning of November 21st, 2004, Young forced his way into the apartment of Daphne Edwards, where she lived with her three young daughters. Pressing a revolver to her head, he demanded money. She gave him $28, all that she had. Young demanded Edwards undress. When she did not do fast enough, Young fired a shot into the ground at her feet. He then sexually assaulted Edwards, with her girls nearby where he could keep an eye on them. On leaving, he walked over to the children and kissed each of them on the cheek and told them that their mommy would be back. Young then forced Edwards, still at gunpoint, into her red Mazda Protege and had her drive to the front of the apartment complex. At that point, Young decided he wanted to drive. He exited the passenger side of the car, telling Edwards not to drive off or he would go back to the apartment and kill her daughters."
This statement comes both from Daphne Edwards and from her husband. And put simply, those facts change everything. It would be a remarkable accusation to make if there was no element of truth in it at all. We're talking about an allegation of rape, and this would have been taken extremely seriously by the police.
So if we're to accept Daphne Edwards' account, what does this omission tell us about Christopher Young? Had he conducted the most hideous of sexual assaults and just decided not to reference it at all in his letters? At the time, we pressed Young on this, and here's what he wrote back.
The incident with Mrs. Edwards is partly true and mostly BS. This is what happened in my case before the murder of the victim. I walked out of my house and seen Miss Edwards parking her car. I was on the way to catch the bus, so when I seen her, I decided to take her car. Before she could exit, I stuck the gun in her face and told her to get out. I got in her car and drove off. My interaction with her was no more than 45 seconds.
This puts a huge question mark on Young's reliability. I can only draw the conclusion that he had somehow hoped that we wouldn't check on the details of his crime towards Daphne Edwards. In his letter to us, Young claims that his interactions with Edwards were less than a minute in duration. He denies going back to her house. He denies sexually assaulting her. But there are multiple witnesses to this event, including young children. And I can see very little incentive for Daphne Edwards or for her husband or any of these witnesses to have concocted this entire event for apparently no real reason.
For me, Daphne Edwards' statement puts Young's credibility sharply into question. Here he is doing good, mentoring other young men, and apologising to the Patel family, but outright failing to acknowledge the other victims forever scarred by his actions.
In this episode of Letters from a Killer, we've heard from the letters of Christopher Young.
I truly believe that death row saved my life, as crazy as that sounds.
He was a man who claimed to have found reform during his time in prison.
I'm a lot more mature, and I'm really glad I came to death row.
But who was ultimately executed by the state for his crimes.
I'm good, Warden.
But when it comes to claiming reform, is doing so without full disclosure a kind of self-betrayal? If you are a genuinely reformed individual claiming to have improved yourself whilst not acknowledging the full extent of what you've done, surely that undermines your ability to state that you have actually changed.
Next time on Letters from a Killer.
It didn't seem like it was me, so violent and mean. It was like I was watching someone else. It must have been the drugs and lack of sleep. I had not planned to kill him. I just needed a ride.
Letters from a Killer was hosted by Zoe Hines and Ned Parker and is a Podimo podcast by Transistor Films. Support the show by sharing on social media and following the podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.